This is Rick Burgess from The Rick Burgess Show. If you're still auto-renewing your car insurance without shopping around, you are probably throwing money away. I'm telling you, go check out Insurify. In about 2 minutes, totally free, you can compare quotes from over 100 companies all in one place. Now, here's what I love. Insurify actually monitors your rates and alerts you when prices drop, so you never miss out on a better deal. Millions of people have used it to stop overpaying, and there's no reason you shouldn't too. Do yourself a favor. See what you can save right now at Insurify.com.
Welcome to the Love Joint Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water straight from your kitchen tap. I reckon it's got to be at least 10 years ago when I saw my first, it was a hot water tap. I'm not even sure it was a cooker back then. It might have even been longer. I remember looking at it and thinking, someone made me a cup of tea from their kitchen sink. And I was like, that's magic. That's the future. Now, you see them everywhere. I mean, they're starting to become pretty commonplace, aren't they, in the house? I tell you what, if you can afford one, I really recommend it. I can't imagine using a kettle now, that's for sure. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. And then just a reminder, mine also does filtered water out of it as well, and sparkling filtered water. And it's both chilled. Fantastic bit of kit. Thank you for all your feedback, by the way. Turns out you lot like all the mad stuff I like learning about too. So that's good news. Today is a bit different. Today I'm curious about how to design an album cover. Had you ever thought about that? I'm also curious about Oasis, the band, because today I'm talking to a guy called Simon Halfen, which I'll tell you all about him in a minute. But just think about album covers just for a minute, because you know, he designs them. They're pieces of art, really, aren't they? We all have our favourite. If not our favourite, we have our most memorable. I remember there was a record shop near me. It's called Strawberry Fields, and it always had Roxy Music. I think the album's Country Life in the Window, which is the two women in their underwear. It was quite shocking, really. I just remember it. I remember always taking a detour to walk past the shop just to have a look at the naked ladies when I was a young boy. Also, I remember The Clash, London Calling. That was always out and about in record shops, wasn't it? Obviously, the Elvis, the kind of remake of the Elvis cover, isn't it? Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks, was everywhere. That Grace Jones album, do you remember that? Island Life, that was everywhere too. It's funny how you remember the album covers so clearly. I'm actually looking at specials. I've got one on my wall here, which was just so brilliant. All the band lined up. Just such a great shot. Aladdin Sane, Abbey Road. How about Parallel Lines, Blondie, Joy Division, Nirvana with Nevermind. I mean, these are all classic album covers, and they just, I don't know, for some reason, they're as big as the art themselves, aren't they? As art themselves. If you want to waste an hour, go to Google and just put in something like the top 10 albums or something like that. And you'll go time traveling back to your youth. So Simon Halfen is graphic designer, most noted for his work, I suppose, with The Jam, Style Council, Oasis, George Michael, Madness, loads of others. He's got two books out. He's got Cover to Cover, which is all about his album covers. He's also got Oasis Supersonic, the complete authorized and uncut interviews. It's from the documentary Supersonic. You must remember that, all about how Oasis went all the way up to Nebworth and how they became the biggest band in the world, according to them. But I mean, it's pretty up there, isn't it? He's got all the interviews stuffed into this book. So we'll talk to him about that. We'll talk to him about the album covers. Here he is. Let's meet Simon. Simon, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here, Tim. Absolutely.
I suppose the first thing we need to do is work out. I've talked about record sleeves, designing that, and I've talked about your relationship with Oasis. So I suppose the first thing we need to do is what actually is your job description these days?
Well, it varies. At my core, I'm a sort of record sleeve designer, and I've done that for the best part of 40 years since the 80s, and but towards the sort of mid 90s, I kind of got involved. I lived in Los Angeles for the first half of the 90s, and I got the film bug. I lived there, as most people do. It's an industry town, and a lot of my friends were either writers, directors, or actors. And I tried to get a couple of things into development, and you know, it was quite a healthy atmosphere, environment there, where things, you know, people would help you out or introduce you to people. So it was quite a good time to be there. And anyway, I moved back to London in the sort of the tail end of the 90s, in 96, and still had a couple of things going, and then had the opportunity to make or remake Sleuth with Jude Law and Michael Caine, which Kenneth Branagh directed in 2000 and whatever it was, 2007, I think. And that was such a magical experience. And, you know, I loved every second of it, to be honest with you. And at that time, it's sort of the design thing. I'm still doing both. And then I think kind of, you know, about 5 or so years ago, things started to quiet. And, you know, designing became like a thumbnail on a iTunes account. You know, that's as far as it kind of went. In fact, I remember, God bless him, sitting with George Michael at this very desk here. And we were doing something for one of his records, one of his singles. And basically, it wasn't having a physical release. It was just an iTunes banner that we had to design. And we sort of did it. And then we just sort of looked at each other very disappointingly, went, is that it? You know? And so it kind of got to the place where design really wasn't that important. Anyhow, Noel was always a very keen supporter of my sort of, you know, film endeavors, if you will. And one afternoon he came here for tea, and you know, straight away said, how busy are you? And I said, why? And he said, well, we, you know, it's coming up to the 20th anniversary of Nebworth, and we'd like to do a documentary. Are you up for it? And I, you know, I grabbed both his arms off for it. I thought it was a great idea. But the more I thought about it, I thought, wow, this is a phenomenon. This is really a special moment in time, and it could. And it sort of warrants a theatrical platform. And I was a big fan of the film Senna, which is, you know, a solely archive-driven film. And I thought we could do the same treatment with Oasis. You know, it's a fabulous story. It's 2.5 years from them signing off to them playing Nebworth and their 2.3 million applications for tickets. So it's really a fantastic moment in time where the band really captured the zeitgeist. So... So that was a very long answer to your question. I do both. And last year I did, earlier this year, I worked on Noel's High Flying Birds greatest hit. So any time, year before, I worked with Peter Blake on the Who latest release, which is, again, a fabulous experience. So, you know, I'm lucky enough to sort of be able to do both.
It seems like you have a great life, and we'll wander through it. We'll talk about Oasis a bit in a minute. But what fascinated me then was you talking about sitting with George Michael and talking about doing like thumbnails or a banner on iTunes. It's so weird how that happened. And obviously, you know that I have a lot of musicians on my TV show, and it's completely gone back to people turning up with vinyl. And the reason why, I believe, is because I actually, in my intro, which you wouldn't have heard, Simon, I discussed how I walked past Strawberry Fields and there was always records in the shop windows. And it was kind of, you know, I was saying they're like art, you know, never mind the Buzzcocks, just beautiful art, you know. Roxy Music, Country Life was the one I always remember because of the two ladies on the front in their underwear, you know. And it's like, you know, you can talk about them all: Abbey Road, Joy Division, Aladdin Sane, etc. And they were like pieces of art. And now it seems it's come full circle from the idea that it was albums, then it went to CDs and cassettes, or CDs, which were smaller versions of it. And now they're all bringing out vinyl again. And I imagine the reason being is just because they want a piece of art to represent them, which is what you do. Is that correct? A bit of design?
I think there's, that's a very nice way of putting it, but I think there's something to be said in that people want to have something to collect. You know, I don't think people want to have their record collection as a number that's on their phone. Look, I've got 10,000 songs. You know, they want to have something that they can see on a shelf or But also, I think that there is a connection. You're absolutely right. There is a connection with the recording artist when you're holding the sleeve. I mean, when we were kids, you'd sit and look at that sleeve forever. You know, you knew every detail, every corner, every sort of glue mark. You knew it inside out. So I think there is something about connecting with an artist through the record sleeve, because in a funny sort of way, it is the front door, you know, of a, you know, it's when you think of an album, all those albums that you said right there, when you think of them, the first thought that comes into your head is the sleeve, you know, right, you know, for better or worse, it is the sleeve. So, you know, I've been lucky enough, and I've said this before, and I think this is absolute truth, that, you know, that I've worked on, I had the good fortune of working on some, you know, iconic record sleeves, but they only become iconic record sleeves because the album's so great, the music's so great. You know, if Stanley Road wasn't a great record musically and was forgotten about, then it wouldn't be, you know, held in such high esteem. And same with things like Listen Without Prejudice or Café Bleu or whatever it is, you kind of get that because they're great records. If they weren't great records, the sleeves would be neither here nor there.
I think you're doing yourself down a bit there. I'm standing here, sitting here looking. I'm going to see if I can turn my computer around actually so you can see this. I'm sitting looking at the Specials. Can you see that? The Specials album cover.
Yeah, fantastic.
And I'm sitting there looking at a big poster of the Specials album cover because, you know, it kind of meant so much to me when I was a kid, having them all stand there in their outfits and everything. It was like, oh, I now know what to do. I need to dress like them. I need two-tone everywhere. And that's, you know, short haircut, you know, get myself some Stay Press. And I knew what to do. And I think it conjured up that whole image for me. And I think it was such an important thing at that stage. I know you were involved in some of the Madness work. And that was always about, they were sort of saying we're a gang, weren't they? Always.
I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, I sort of cut my teeth. My very first job was working at Stiff Records. So, and that was around about the time when the second Madness album had come out. So Baggy Trousers and Embarrassment were the hits when I first started there. And I remember, I was working in the post room and, I think very early days, Suggs came in and sort of introduced himself. I am Suggs, and I was a massive fan from even before I'd heard of them, because I went to see them. I went to see the Pretenders at the Lyceum, and before Madness even had a record out, they were supporting. And genuinely, I'd not heard of them. And Chaz Smash Carl was sort of wheeled on a barrow, and he grabs the mic and goes, "Hey, you don't watch that, watch this." And they blew the roof off the joint. It was just like, my God, these guys are something else. And it was the most fantastic gig. You know, I didn't want to be the sort of Pretenders. I wouldn't have wanted to be the Pretenders to come on to follow that. And so, I was very lucky to kind of walk into that world, in the post room at Stiff and see these guys, and then sort of, by some weird, for someone who ended up in the art department, I was very lucky. And but it was the time when imagery and record sleeves, especially at Stiff Records, was so important. You know, everything was about posters, ads, how everything was marketed. And I mean, they didn't use the word marketing. It was just how everything was presented. And it was such fun and so exciting to be sort of, I guess you don't even appreciate it for what it was at the time. You just realize, you look at stuff and think it looks great, but now looking back, you realize how important all that stuff was.
Everything's so important. And I had a show called only lasted a very short period of time. It's called Tim Lovejoy and the All Stars. I took the All Stars name from the sort of ska shit that I loved so much. After the first pilot we did, he had something like six cameras to do the bands, and I took them away from him. I said, "You've got three cameras now." And he goes, "Why?" And I said, "Because my memory of good bands was years ago when the old grey whistle test or Top of the Pops or something, it didn't have 35 cameras to cut around. So the way the band lined up was really important. So, you know, you've got the drummer at the back. Say, let's take Oasis, for instance. You know, you always know you've got Liam front of stage, you've got Noel to the left of him. You know, and it's like that's how they lined up. Noel didn't come centre stage. Well, he did when he sung. But, you know, that's how the band lined up. You know how the Beatles line up. You know how the Stones line up. And the bands absolutely loved it because we'd take long shots of them standing there as a group of men and women, or, you know, whatever, just stood there as the band. And the image is so important. And we started getting bands, we did it all in white, and we started getting bands going, oh, I've got to dress up for this, because they suddenly realized that it was like, wow, it's like a, you know, it's the image. We're projecting the image. And I think that was so important. I'm talking a lot here, but it was, you know, these days it's like, go on TikTok and say a few words or do a silly dance or, you know, do an interview with a fan or something. Whereas, you know, those days it was, how the fuck do we look when the TVs are on us or the cameras are on us? And that was what it was all about, right?
But back then it was doubly important, because this is almost sort of pre-VHS. So, you know, when you saw someone on Top of the Pops or you saw them on the old grey whistle test, that was it. You had to sort of be there to see it. And you had to think, oh, what are they wearing? What are they doing? You know, you had to really be paying attention. And the other way of kind of keeping up with stuff is the NME. Kind of saying, oh, right, okay, what are those shoes? What are, you know, what's that shirt? You know, and you really hung on. The mystique was still there. I think perhaps nowadays the mystique is gone with bands. Because everything is available 24/7 and there's always bits of information thrown at you or given to you. So I think that kind of little bit of cloud of mystery that allowed you to embellish in your own mind what was really going on and what these guys were thinking or doing, has gone now.
I have this argument with my friends all the time. I don't want my superstars, my rock stars and stuff. I don't want them on social media because I don't want them to come down to our level. You know what I mean? I mean, I can't be asked to do it. So how the hell they can? You know, I don't want to know that my rock star's on a running machine, a treadmill, you know, or because it does. It's not what, even though I like the fact they are, I don't want to know that. I want to just think they turn up and they look brilliant because they are a rock star. That's it.
This has kind of all been brought home. I was very fortunate last week to go to a screening of a preview of Beatles Get Back. And this is something that's been sitting in a cupboard for 50 years now. And you think, my God, this is the mystique is still there. You're looking at these guys and you feel like, after all this time, you actually feel like you're in the room with them. And it genuinely feels that way. And it's absolutely awesome. And this is just these guys doing what they do. And you're looking at the shoes, you're looking at the shirt, but you're hearing these songs taking form, you know, which is just an incredible, you know, experience for us now to be able to see that. But if we'd have had that at the time, these being drip fed all this, oh, and here's George working out, you know, whatever it is, something, or here's this one doing that, and oh, here's a little bit of this. The mystique would have gone in a second, I think. And I think that's the thing about the Beatles is that it's all about the mystique, you know, they've got the songs and everything to back it up, but it's the mystique that surrounds them, and that still lives on to this day.
That footage you got we're all over the place here, but hopefully our listeners will go with it. I'm going to come back to designing record sleeves in a minute. But that footage you've got from Supersonic, because you were talking about the Beatles and everything. Some of the footage you had in that, it's a while since I watched it, but that early stuff of when Noel sort of just has joined the band and stuff. Where was all that? Why were people filming that sort of stuff? It's so bizarre. You've got that.
I mean, a lot of the time we were lucky. I mean, the one we were especially lucky with was the footage of the band playing at King Tut's, which was the famous gig where they were supporting 18 Wheeler, where Alan McGee turns up and signs them on the spot. And that turns out that she was just a student living in Scotland that had come from somewhere east, far east, I can't remember where now, but she was a massive 18 Wheeler fan, and she just happened to film the support, you know, videotape the support band. And then it took a while. We knew that that tape existed, but then it took a while to track her down. And I think it was done through, you know, the researcher kind of joining up the dots, because she was doing something to do with stained glass, and they managed to find her through some Facebook stained glass group. And so we tracked her down, and she says, yeah, I think I've still got that tape in my parents' loft. So it was sort of just having good luck, because it wasn't, you know, it's obviously the whole thing is pre-phones with cameras, it's pre-mobile phones, full stop, I think, for the most part.
Yeah, it definitely was. Yeah, I worked at the Big Breakfast when Oasis had sort of hit big. It was 94, I was there, I think, till 96 or 93 till 96, I'm not sure. But one of my friends worked at the label, and she sent me, because she was trying to get them on the Big Breakfast or something, right? She sent me a load of CDs, and she sent me a tape of all their TV, early TV appearances, and we used to sit and watch it at night. Me and the lads, we used to get drunk and sit around when we all lived together in this flat, because it was just, we just laughed so much, because it was just two people sitting there, and you've got so much of it in that, you had so much of it in that documentary, with Liam going, and I'll fucking take anyone on, and Noel's going, look at our kid there, and it was just it was just brilliant watching people not play. Actually, Madness were the same in a different way. They wouldn't play the game. And that's what I loved, when people won't play the game. But they're not offensive. Every time I interviewed Liam or Noel, actually, I haven't really interviewed Liam that much. Noel is always brilliant. He's always brilliant. Never swears, never does anything, but always says really exciting things, but refuses to play the game. If you go to Liam, Noel, before Soccer AM or something, you go, do you want to go into makeup? He goes, I'm not putting makeup on. I'm a rock and roll star. That's what he'll say. Do you know what I mean? He's like, I don't put makeup on. You know, it's like, he's just brilliant. He just doesn't, they don't play the game. And that's what you want.
I mean, my experience, I mean, I was very fortunate. You know, I sort of became friends with them quite early. I was living in Los Angeles, and they'd come out to shoot a video for Supersonic, for the track Supersonic. With Nick Egan, the director Nick Egan, who was a friend of mine. And so we went down to the shoot. And just prior to going down to the shoot, I'd mentioned to Paul Weller that I was going to go down there. And he goes, oh, tell me mates of mine, you know. So straight away I say, oh, Paul says to say hi. And he says, oh, all right. You know, and so that immediately gave me my sort of gold card access, if you like. And so every time we got on well, we hit it off from the get-go, and every time they'd breeze into town for a gig or another video shoot or whatever it was, we'd hang out. And so I was sort of very lucky to have that sort of access to, and hang out with them early on. And then when I moved back from LA in the second half of the 90s, they were living around the corner from me, so I kind of, you know, go around and watch the football around at Knowles, and we just moved into Supernova Heights, and it was just a really fun time to be around them. And then as we sort of came to the end of the decade, they asked me to design their record sleeve, so I came on board for sort of Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, and did three or four in total, ending up with working with Peter Blake again on Stop the Clocks. It was just I never took it for granted, because they had this rehearsal/demo studio out in High Wycombe called Wheeler End. And we sort of nicknamed it the sort of Wheeler End Gentlemen's Club. And I'd go up there and sort of take a few things, say, oh, come on, we're in the studio this week, come on, bring your camera, you know. And they'd just make you feel like part of the team immediately. And it'd literally just be the band, Noel's kind of guitar tech, Jason Rhodes, and myself. And you know, they'd be going through the, you know, rehearsing the set, you know, in a room no bigger than most people's living rooms, large size living room, and then that same, you know, playing that same set a week later, you know, Wembley Stadium. You know, it was quite I never took for granted how lucky I was to be in that position. But the thing about spending time with them was that, you know, 95% of the time you'd just be laughing, you know, because they're just funny. They're just really, really funny guys. And, you know, it was a fantastic experience. Yeah. I mean, 5%, you know, it could get a bit, you know, ugly, not ugly, but there'd be that, you know, I was sort of liken it to you know, as soon as you heard one of them say, "Oh, what do you mean by that?" And you thought, "Oh, here we go." And then it's almost you'd be in a saloon and the barman's turning around the mirror and sort of hiding behind the bar, and everyone takes a couple of steps back. But you know, whenever there were those kind of exchange of words, you know, they'd forgotten about it the next day. It was only the kind of people that kind of witnessed it were thinking, "Oh, is it safe to go back in the water?" And it always was.
So the thing about Noel, especially, I know them both a bit, but I know Noel more. And it just, I always say he's one of the funniest guys. Him and Ray Winston, just like, they're not comedians, but they're so funny, both of them.
Noel's as sharp as a tack.
But the thing about them, and I always say this about all the comedians as well, all the people I see have this massive success are always really smart. He's such a smart guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's as you say, raised a sharp brain, and you know, he really knows his stuff. So I wonder, when you're coming to design a record sleeve, I imagine he's got a lot of input in it, and I imagine he's got visions as well as you. How do you come to think about what you're going to do with a band like Oasis?
Well, it's interesting. On Standing at the Shoulder of Giants, it was slightly...
Remind us what that one looked like for people who can't remember.
Like New York skyline. And originally that was going to be a much closer... it was going to be the top of a skyscraper. And it was going to be the five of them walking in silhouette. It was copying another... it's a photographer called Rene Barie, and he did a similar thing in South America, of just four or five guys walking, must be either at sunrise or sunset, where there's a huge silhouette behind them, so you can't really see them, you can just see the silhouettes and the shadows. And we thought that would make a great album cover. So Noel said, "I'll come down to the south of France." This was the 90s, so we're recording in the south of France, let's go down there and we can sort of talk it through with the rest of them. So I get down there, I go with Noel down to the fly to Nice, and they're staying at this chateau where they were recording the album. And so I've got my bag, and he says, "Oh, you could have Bonehead's room." I said, "Oh, has he gone home?" He goes, "No, he's left the band." I thought, "Oh, well, I wasn't expecting that." And then Grigsy left very quickly thereafter. And so then we had the issue. So, well, we can't really put the band on the album cover, because even though they played on the record, there's no band anymore at this point. So we took that idea and sort of expanded it and made it much more of the whole New York skyline. But just on the top of one building, you can see in, you know, very, very small, there's five kids playing football on top of a rooftop. So that was sort of how we kind of, it turned out really nice. And my friend Andrew McPherson photographed it again, sort of pre-digitally, where he literally spent 18 hours on a rooftop snapping to get, you know, dusk to dawn images of the New York skyline, and then layered them in a very clever way. So we kind of did that. We kind of got a get out of jail free card, thinking, "Oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that instead." And it worked out. And a lot of the time it is just kind of by the, you know, the seat of your pants or the skin of your teeth or whatever it is, because, you know, you've got to get them all to agree on something. But, you know, it's primarily, you know, with Oasis, it was kind of Noel that had the deciding factor, because he was the sort of captain of the ship.
What do you think of the early ones, our early album sleeves, the Oasis ones?
Oh, yeah, no, I really like those. And, you know, Brian Cannon did a great job. You know, he's a good designer, Brian, and it worked so well for those records. Again, you know, they work perfectly, I think. And I was thrilled to get the nod from Noel. I don't know why. I mean, we were obviously friends, but, you know, I guess he just felt there was a time for change. And as I say, the band hadn't changed when he'd asked me. They kind of changed. You know, Grigsy and Bonehead left after I was already on board. But I was thrilled to do it. And then I went on to do Heathen Chemistry, and which was an interesting one, because we didn't really have a plan other than, Noel's idea was, let's go to Paris for a week and just do some photographs and, you know, take pictures on the fly, as it were. So we did that, but it was kind of the longest week of any of our lives, I think.
The definitely maybe one, I get. It's really because it's so iconic, isn't it? The band sitting in a room and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, you know, the amount of people who said, I want my room to be like that because of the album. But what's the story, Morning Glory, is Sean Rowley, isn't it, walking down... I used to work with, actually, at the Big Breakfast.
I've known Sean for 100 years.
Yeah. Nice guy, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah. And it's him just walking down a street in Soho, isn't it? I kind of don't know what that's got to do with Oasis. But, I mean, you don't question it because it is what it is. But it's I don't know what the connection is between Sean and Soho. What is it?
It goes back to my point as well that these things become iconic because the music's so great. I think ordinarily, if that was, you know, an album, you know, if that had been, oh, I don't know, Corduroy's second album cover, you probably wouldn't be talking about it today. Do you know what I mean? But it was Oasis, and it was, you know, sort of a masterpiece of a record, and the two, you know, work hand in hand. So it works.
Well, it works, but it's such a bizarre, don't you think it's a really bizarre decision? Because you think about, like, the first album, the band, you think about the Verve and stuff who were around at the time. It's the band, it's the clothes, yeah. It's what we're all buying into. And then you've got, like, a Cockney, Sean Rowley, like, yeah. Walking down a street in London, Soho. Well, it's got no connection in my mind at all to Oasis, yeah, apart from the fact that it's iconic. But go on.
I'm not a fan of that world, particularly those sort of Hypnosis Pink Floyd album covers. Pink Floyd are not really my band, I've got to be honest. So I know that's sort of sacrilege in certain circles, but you know, it's almost like the same idea of, you know, having two people, you know, shaking hands and one of them's on fire or whatever it is. It's just that kind of weird, the same person's going backwards and forwards thing. So I can see it's almost like perhaps an homage to that kind of sleeve design. I don't know, but
I'd love to know is the process behind that, where people were sitting at the, I'd like to know the designer, the label, Noel, the rest of the band, how everyone sat there when that came along and went, yeah, this is it, this will do. I just can't get it. Whereas, you know, you look at Specials album, Madness album, you know, I get the New York skyline, it kind of is aspirational, isn't it?
Yeah, they could say the same about that, because, you know, it's just like, what's this got to do with, what's New York got to do with Oasis?
Oh, sorry, New York, yeah.
What's that got to do with Oasis? And you just think, oh, you know, a lot of, you know, I'm sure people did think that, going, what's going on here? So I think
I thought you've explained it now, but I thought what it always represented was the fact that they were all going on about they're the best band in the world and stuff, and they were conquering everything. And I thought that was sort of what it looked like. They were on top of the world sort of thing.
There was a little bit of that, but I think sometimes when you do something, you look for those explanations. Because they're on top of the world, and they're the biggest band. You know, doing it, but it's like, sure, that's why we did it. You know, someone, you know, like you could self would say it, and then all of a sudden that becomes the idea for doing it.
This is Rick Burgess from The Rick Burgess Show. If you're still auto renewing your car insurance without shopping around, you are probably throwing money away. I'm telling you, go check out Insurify. In about 2 minutes, totally free, you can compare quotes from over 100 companies all in one place. Now, here's what I love. Insurify actually monitors your rates and alerts you when prices drop, so you never miss out on a better deal. Millions of people have used it to stop overpaying, and there's no reason you shouldn't too. Do yourself a favor. See what you can save right now at Insurify.com.
All right, let's talk about two areas I'd like to talk about with design. By the way, did you have any background? Did you have any education in this, or you were just at Stiff and went, I fancy doing this, and just had a talent for it?
Stiff Records, I was very lucky at Stiff Records. I was a massive Clash fan, and I bumped into Cosmo Vinyl that summer. I didn't know Cosmo. I'd seen Cosmo introduce the Clash at a gig, but I knew who he was. And I saw him walking down Oxford Street and got chatting to him. And he happened to mention in that conversation that he was working out of Stiff Records. So I'd left university, you know, very brief, you know, after a brief year there. And I wanted to work for a record company. And, you know, having met Cosmo, I thought, well, I'm connected. I know Cosmo. So I knew he was working out of Stiff Records. So I just plonked myself down there one morning at about 9:30. And I said, and this is when they were above the old cab office in Westbourne Grove. And the lady behind the switchboard, as it was back then, said, well, he doesn't come in most days, but if he does come in, he comes in in the afternoon. And so I said, well, do you mind if I wait? And I said, sure. So I sat on a chair and literally, you know, 45 minutes later, in bowls Cosmo, who was this kind of larger than life.
Yeah, you better you better explain for people who don't know who he is. Yeah,
Cosmo Vinyl was kind of like the Clash aide de camp, if you like. He was the kind of like their right. He wasn't their manager, but he was their right hand man, and he was. He looked like one of them. In fact, he sort of looked better than them. If you can do that. He'd walk in wearing a Homburg and a Crombie and just larger than life. And when he came into the office, it was like a bolt of lightning. He was like, what? You know, West Ham fan, but you can't have everything. So anyway, so he looks at me, half recognizing me. He goes, and I said, oh, yeah, I've come to see you. And he goes, oh, all right. So he takes me into the post room, which was empty. And the post room was kind of like wall-to-wall boxes of records and posters, no light in there. And he said, how can I help you? And I said, well, look, I want to come and work for you. And he goes, well, the Clash aren't doing anything at the minute. And this was just before, it was after London Calling, just before Sandinista came out. And he said, so I'm not earning anything. He says, hang on a minute. So he goes out the post and comes back in 5 minutes later and goes, do you want to work here? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. So boom, I started there and then working in the post room. So, and I did that for a good few months. And then I became a plugger, which was, you know, I kind of got promoted to being a plugger's assistant or whatever. And that was a horrible job. I didn't enjoy that at all. And you used to have to go up to Radio One and you'd have to know who the secretary was for a particular producer, for a particular DJ. And I couldn't figure out who any of them were. So I'd go up with a box of records to Radio One and I'd come back into the office and Sonny, who was the plugger, the sort of chief plugger, would say, how'd you get on? I said, oh, no one was in. So I then ended up in the art department, as you say, but with no training whatsoever, because I'd become friends with Vaughan Toulouse, who was the singer of Department S, and they'd just signed to the label. And he said, oh, I want to do my own records today. And I said, oh, I'll help you. That sounds like fun. So we came in one Sunday and we just, you know, cobbled it together ourselves. And it turned out all right. It was nothing to particularly write home about. But I think because I was doing such a lousy job as being a plugger, but they kind of liked having me around, they moved me into the art department. So I kind of slightly learnt the ropes there, but not really. I really learnt the ropes because another ex-employee who was working there but had just left was Neville Brody. And Neville Brody is one of the greatest sort of British designers now. And was shortly after he went off to and created the look of the face and was the designer for the face and everything. Anyway, he kind of, after about 6 months of being in the art department, he said, oh, do you want to come and work for me? I need an assistant. And that's where I really kind of learnt the ropes. And Neville was he didn't teach me. I just learnt from being around him. And so that was a big moment for me. And it was that coincided because I'd become friendly with Paul Weller at that time. And so again, just socially through Gary Crowley, who I met by when I was a plugger, because I'd gone to Top of the Pops and I was gone with Tempole Tudor. I don't know if you remember Tempole Tudor. Yep. They had a massive sort of 1,000 men and their stage outfit was chainmail. So I was the guy carrying 4 bin liners of chainmail for Tempole Tudor, and Gary Crowley held open the door for me. And, you know, I don't know if you know Gary, but within about 15 seconds, you know, he said to me, you fan of the Jam? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, I could sort you out with some acetates or something. So we hit it off and became friends and are friends to this day.
I love Gary, by the way. I used to go and see it. He used to play all the like soul clubs and stuff around the area. And
Gary, bless him. So anyway,
yeah, I used to go and see him, and I had a few mutual friends. So over the years, I've bumped into Gary loads. I don't know him as a friend, but I'm a massive fan of him and his work.
That's the connection with Sean Rowley as well, because I think I met Sean through Gary, because they used to DJ at the WAG together, and back in, again, this is going back to the 80s. So anyway, I through Gary, I got to know Paul a little bit. And again, the Jam were very open. Again, when I was working at Stiff, you know, you'd hear that the Jam were recording at Air Studios, which was in Oxford Circus. So you could just pop in there, you know, what are you doing? You know, and you'd have a little chat and they'd play you something. And then I remember one time being in a white label of Town Called Malice, you know, 12-inch white label.
Wow.
And it was just like, that was all my Christmases and birthdays wrapped up in once. You know, walk back to the office with the white label. Yeah, I've got this off call, you know, the biggest band in the country, you know, and super excited. So anyway, I was working at the Face offices with Neville, and then it kind of got started. Funnily enough, my sort of plugging days through Tempo Tudor, I'd become friendly with Kim Wilde. Because she was going out with the guitarist, Bob Kingston from Tempo Tudor. And Kim said, when I left Stiff and gone to work for Neville and was starting to do stuff on my own, she said, you can do my next single. So she gave me my sort of first break in a way, because that was the first kind of proper gig that I got. And then I got a call from Paul, and he says, do you want to come down to the studio tomorrow? I'll have a chat with you about something. And they had a studio in Marble Arch called Solid Bond Studios. And this is like at the tail end of the Jam. I think the Jam had just announced, or were about to announce, that they were splitting up. And he said, so he takes me into the kitchen, a cup of tea, yeah, coffee, yeah, lovely, one sugar. Do you fancy doing, I'm starting this new band, do you fancy doing the sleeves? So... And that was the Style Council, and I sort of ended up working with Paul for the best part of 30 years from that point on. But it was, you know, I was kind of learning as I was going. You know, I didn't
Is there any money in designing record label sleeves? Sorry to be crude, but I'm just sitting there thinking, it's like, you know, because you've done a book with 200 odd of them in and the stories, but do you make money doing them? Is it a good gig?
You make a living. It's not, it's. I'm sure there are people that have earned a fortune out of doing those things. Perhaps not a fortune, but have done very well. It's like that old Jewish joke where, the old Jewish guy gets run over or hit by a car in Gold is Green. And someone puts a, jacket and puts it under his head and says, are you comfortable? And he goes, I earn a living.
Right.
So, but it's the same thing, you know. I've managed to kind of earn a living and go away with it over the years.
Because I suppose if you're ranking and you go, can you come and do the new album cover? He goes, yeah, 100 grand. But if you're an assistant in an office and you're doing Kim Wilde, you're going, I'm doing it for free, basically, or buy me a few drinks.
I think if memory serves me correctly, I think you got paid like 250 quid or something for doing that Kim Wilde thing, which, bear in mind, that was probably 10 weeks wages.
Right. Okay. So it's still not bad.
Yeah. So it wasn't bad, you know. Yeah. So I've been very lucky to sort of be in the right place and the right time.
Let's talk about Weller then and the Style Council and the Jam, because obviously, like everybody, when the Jam decides to split up, we're all furious. You know, it's like when the Specials released more Specials, we're all a bit like, what? You know, and then when they started turning up, like, not wear, you know, in their sort of reindeer jumpers and moccasins on top of the box, like, what? And then when they turn into the Fun Boy 3, we're like, what? I mean, now I love it all, but you're not happy when it happens, when you're a kid and your band changes. And obviously Weller just wanted to remove himself so far away. I think it's quite well documented. He wanted to remove himself from the whole Jam and the mod culture and everything. So that's a pretty big task when the album comes along, that or the singles or whatever, whichever, I can't remember which order it happened, that you've got to create an image for him. And I think what you guys produced was kind of phenomenal, because I thought it was so unusual. And I remember thinking, oh wow, this is like European culture, which I know is what it all was, but it was like, look at Weller, he's so bloody stylish. You nailed it, you two of you.
Yeah, well, listen, that's very kind of you to say so, but, you know, no one gets up in the morning and tells Paul Weller what to wear. You know, he's got that kind of sussed. And so he just had, you know, he had a very good aesthetic and knew what he wanted to achieve. I mean, I think he didn't set out to sort of create the anti-Jam, but I think everything about the Style Council was, in his mind, was going to be different to what the Jam did. It wasn't going to be an album tour as, you know, a yearly thing that the Jam did year in, year out, because I think he just got fed up with that. And when the Style Council first started, he wasn't interested in playing live at all. Just sort of, you know, wasn't even interested in picking up a guitar. So he had, you know, it was the era of the Burberry Mac and the loafer and the Levi's rolled up and the button-down shirt. And these things sound like, oh, what's so special about that? But in those days, it was quite hard to get that stuff. You know, I mean, you could get a Burberry Mac, but, you know, the right Levi's are quite hard to get. Button-down shirts, you still had to get from America, or if you were lucky to, you know, John Simon's in Covent Garden might have them in stock, but that was it. So it was really about finding the clothes of the Lacoste cardigans. You could, you know, they're just hard to find, those things. It wasn't something you could just go to Selfridges or the high street and pick up. So Paul really wanted to play on that. And, you know, I think it was all about that imagery to start with, you know, the detail of those images, of that imagery. And also the, as you rightly pointed out, it's that kind of European culture. You know, Paul started smoking Gauloises and, you know, walking around with a rolled up copy of the Paris Match in his pocket, you know. So it was all on drinking cappuccinos. In fact, I saw Neil Tennant a couple of years ago, and I didn't really know Neil, but I remember our paths had crossed over the years, and I bumped into him at a party. And, you know, I remember when he came to interview the Style Council when he was still at Smash Hits, and we were talking about that, and he said, oh, before the Style Council, we were still drinking frothy coffee. You know, it only became cappuccino after the Style Council came along.
I've got to say, Simon, I know you know this story, but I'm going to name drop it for my listeners here. But one of my favourite things ever was being at Noel Gallagher's 40th birthday party, and Noel going to me. You've met Weller, haven't you? And I'd never met Weller at that stage in my life. I've seen him around and stuff, but never met him. And he calls him over and goes, Weller, Lovejoy, Weller. And I noticed his shoes, and I went, Paul, I love your shoes. And he just started, he goes, they're Italian. And then he started talking to me all about the leather and everything. And I was like, This is exactly what I wanted. I didn't talk to him about the Jam. I didn't talk to him about anything or the Style Council or his solo career. I talked about shoes. And I was like, this is what I want, this style chat. And he loved his Italian loafers so much that night. I thought, brilliant, because he's such a stylish man, isn't he?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think... you know, that was you know, obviously the, you know, even the band being called the Style Council. But we were lucky. The thing that was always at the heart of the Style Council was to have fun. And I think there was that thing where Paul knew that he was pissing a lot of people off as well by doing things that were so not in the Jam playbook.
Yeah.
So you know, it was done, you know, just for, you know, for a laugh really. But it did, you know, our influences were, you know, I've been a Beatles fan forever. So the Beatles were always an influence in the way that sort of kind of nicked ideas for the layouts for back of sleeves and even the sort of the gatefold for our favourite shop. The style of gatefold came from Beatles for Sale, which was my first ever record. And that was given as a child. And I just loved that record. And but, you know, it wasn't just that. It was things like Blue Note, which was a, you know, I didn't know about this Blue Note other than going into record stores and discovering. And it wasn't like there was a book today. You've got books on everything. You can go and browse and find everything. But in those days, you kind of had to, you know, flick through the record stores. And if you were lucky enough to find copies, and my brother was living in New York. So I would go and visit him on a regular basis. And I'd come back with, you know, carrier bags full of, old original Blue Note records, because it was just, you could still get them there and they were still reasonably, you know, priced. And that would be our kind of, oh, let's do something like that. We were very magpie-ish in the sense of, oh, we can do that then. Let's just do it like that, you know. So a lot of it was quite clumsily borrowed, I think, is the...
Oh, yeah, no, but you have the vision to do it. Let's move on to... by the way, are anyone listening to this, if you're as old as me and you can remember it, the Jam, Paul Weller lost us all for a short period of time. Everyone was like, nah, sod you, because he'd left the Jam and everything, and to get us all back with the Style Council was just brilliant, I thought, by the way, because there was a period where we're like, no way. And then it's like, look at his hair, look at everything about him. And then it's suddenly like, hold on, I want a piece of that. So it kind of brilliantly worked. And now you look back, it's hard for us to go who's your favourite, Style Council or The Jam, which one do you like the best? Let's go to George Michael, one of the most famous men in the world, and you decide to not put him on the cover, or you both decide not to put him on the cover of Listen Without Prejudice. I mean, that's kind of a big decision.
That wasn't my decision. This is coming up to the end of the 80s. This would have been around about 1989. And I'd become friendly with him again. I originally met George, I think, through Gary Crowley. I think it was, we'd gone out to lunch at Langan's, of all places, which is a sort of a regular spot back in the day. And so I got to know him, and then I became friendly with him because he lived up the road from me. I lived in Swiss Cottage and he lived up in Hampstead. I remember once, you know, we all went out for dinner and he dropped me home afterwards. I was the last one out the car kind of thing. And I remember saying to him, I said, listen, I'm the next one. If you fancy it, I'd love to have a crack at designing your next record sleeve. And which was Listen Without Prejudice. And he said, oh God, yeah, I don't know why I didn't think of it. Yeah, great idea. Boom. So the original idea was, because of the faith thing, that whole experience, the faith experience for him, of him being this kind of elevated, I mean, Wham was huge, but faith elevated him to this whole new stratosphere of sort of pop stardom, rock stardom, whatever you want to call it. I mean, that album, which is really unusual, the Faith album was number one for two consecutive Christmases.
Wow.
So that shows you, in the US, so that shows you the lifespan of that record. It wasn't number one for an entire year, but the fact that number one for two consecutive Christmases was just sort of unheard of. So he was, you know, it's a stratospheric album, propelled into this new level of kind of a rock star, pop star. And I think ultimately he didn't enjoy it. I think the Wham thing he enjoyed because he had his pal Andrew with him, so he had someone to share it with. So I think he found this whole George Michael pop star a very solitary role. So he felt that he was being, and this is well documented, I'm not saying anything that you probably don't already know, but he felt that he was being looked at as a pop star rather than as a songwriter, singer songwriter. And that was important to him. Excuse me, because his role models were, you know, Elton John, obviously, but people of that, from that ilk. And so he didn't want to be seen as just, you know, a pop star. And so the idea was, right, on this next record sleeve, I'm going to call it Listen Without Prejudice, because he wanted people to hear the record without having any preconceptions about him or what he looked like or whatever it was. And so the original idea was just to do a plain blue record sleeve with a kind of a sort of George Michael in a varnish or an embossed thing on it. And so we actually, George paid to have some proofs done, proofs of like a running sheet of what the record sleeve will look like, fully printed. And so they look great, you know, really sort of glossy and, oh, this is cool, something different. So I sent it to his manager in the US, overnighted it by Federal Express, and I get a call from Francis, his PA, who was lovely. And Rob, I'd got to know, Rob was a fairly brash individual, but I got on very well with him. And so Francis, hey, I have Rob Cahane for you. Hi, Rob, how are you? Are you fucking kidding me? So he said, you can't possibly think this is going to be the record sleeve for George's next record. He said, listen, it's career suicide. You know, Walmart's, blah, 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 all these places, they won't stock it. And so, oh, okay, then. Let me go and have a chat. So I go and have a chat with him. And I said, well, listen, I think we've got to go back to the drawing board. You know, Rob's not having it. The record label won't accept it, blah, blah, blah. He sort of dug his heels in for a minute. And then he said, what should we do? And I bought him a book of sort of 20th century photography. And again, as I mentioned earlier, there weren't that many sort of coffee table books back in the sort of late 80s. There were certainly some, but not like today. So he said, oh, let's have a flick through here, see if we can get some inspiration. And we flick through. And then we see that Ouija shot of, you know, a million people on Coney Island. And we both looked at each other and went, that's the album cover. And so we got the rights to that, and sort of everyone was happy. But I think the record company would have liked to have had his image on the cover. But that's the way he wanted to do it. He wanted it to be the music just to be heard. And
he always played with image, didn't he? His videos were huge. Everything he did was huge in that way. And I think that's what people forget in music. I mean, I know all the artists go, I just want you to judge me on the music, but it's bollocks because we don't. We judge you on what you look like and everything. And I'm going to do full circle here because I'm going to come back to Oasis. Because you've got the book out, Oasis Supersonic, the complete authorized and uncut interviews, and I was flicking through there, and it's funny because Oasis, they've become, we know them so well that you sort of forget what they were. You know, they become kind of like the Beatles, they sort of become pantomimey, or the Stones, because you know them so well. You forget the attitude that arrived with that band, and the fact they're wearing the great clothes. Like Liam, you were saying earlier, whatever Liam wore, everyone was interested. You know, he was like sort of, I don't know, David Beckham and Liam Gallagher both shaved their heads, both that made front page news if they did.
Yeah, exactly. Literally front page headlines. Yeah.
They could turn up with a new Parker, white Parker, and everyone go, Jesus, where did he get that from? And it's like just that everybody was obsessed with what they were wearing on their feet and what, you know, it's kind of just the whole thing with the image. And I was flicking through the book. Now, this book is interviews which didn't make the documentary, yeah, aren't they? So you've got everything in there.
The book really came about as sort of a lockdown project, really, because I think everyone was looking for things to do that where they didn't have to leave the house. And I'd long had it at the back of my mind, knowing when we were making the film, because the film was only 2 hours long, how much stuff we had to leave out. It's 16 hours with Noel, 12 with Liam, plus all the people, you know, whether it's Peggy and Paul Gallagher, all the people closest to them. And the stuff that was left out wasn't because it wasn't good enough, but it's just because we didn't have the time. So I said to Noel, I said, listen, what do you think about doing a book? Just putting all the interviews in. I said, the stuff in there, I mean, it's gold. It's either comedy gold or it's very touching or it completely tells the picture. And, you know, they're incredibly candid. I think because it was 20 years after the event and enough time had come since they'd split up, they were happy to talk quite candidly about what had gone on and about their growing up and stuff that we hadn't heard before. So I said, it's a shame not to capture it all and put it all into a book. And he was up for it immediately. No, Liam said the same. So as long as I can read it first, yeah, I'm definitely up for it. And it sort of became the perfect bookend in a way, because the film was so well received. Fans loved it. The band loved it. Critics loved it. It kind of ticked all the boxes. So it just seemed like the perfect sort of bookend, forgive the pun, for the project to assemble it all and, you know, illustrate it in the same way that the film is kind of illustrated. So it's a nice big chunky sort of 400-page book that kind of tells that story, that kind of cuts it off at Nebworth, which is exactly what the film did.
Yeah, and it's such a shame, isn't it? Because Liam's playing Nebworth again, isn't he? I mean, Liam's back, like, huge. Noel never went away, but Liam sort of went away a bit, had his BDI stuff and a few other odds and sods. But he's back now, just absolutely huge, because he's so iconic and people want him. He's Supersonic. But, you know, I just want Noel to be at Nebworth with him, don't you?
It's funny you should say that. I'm not sure that I sort of go along with that, really, because I think, again, it's going back to that thing we just sort of discussed earlier, that mystique. And I think when you see Oasis, it's like the Beatles, for example. You would hate it if the Beatles, you know, no disrespect intended here at all, but if the Beatles had ended up like the Rolling Stones and they're just getting kept on going on and on and on and on. And you know, obviously the taking out the equation, the tragedies that have happened along the way with them. But even if they'd gone through the 70s, the fact that they stopped in 69 and the last time you see them is where they're looking as cool as possibly can be on the roof of Savile Row.
I tell you what, this is going to be like a pub argument, because I went to the Rolling Stones exhibition. And I've watched a load of Stones documentaries recently. and the Stones were like so stupidly, ridiculously cool. Then they went through this horrific stage where Jagger's wearing baseball clothes and stuff to do his tour in that sort of like 80s or something. I don't know. Yeah. Just terrible. And then they become cool again. They go through this like roller coaster of cool and not cool. And I think the Beatles would have been exactly the same. And I think all the bands, yeah, if they could.
The Beatles, though, you just want it to be perfect, and it's perfect now. There's not one thing about the Beatles that you can say, oh, they shouldn't have done that, or they shouldn't have, you know, it's everything that they did is just kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of frozen in time and it's perfect. There's nothing to block the landscape in any way, shape or form. And I think in many ways, that's the same with Oasis. I think if they were to get back together, I think they could only match the heights that they received. I think a lot of these bands that do get back together, whether it's the Stone Roses or those sorts of bands, you know, then they end up playing these massive things because they didn't really do that other than Stone. What was it called again? I forgot the name of the gig that they did.
Spike Island.
So they never really did those stadium gigs, whereas Oasis did those and they did them many times over. So they would only try and, I think, match what they've already previously done. I'm one for sort of leaving things as they were. Noel's couldn't be happier doing what he's doing, and Liam's doing great, you know, two nights at Nebworth on his own.
Simon, you're so wrong. Get them back together again. It was just magical. It's really interesting, actually, because I'm reading this. It's right. I've got to rewatch the documentary, actually, because it was just like this perfect storm of Noel being in Spiral Carpets, roadie, and not really caring that much. And then it all just came together, didn't it? Liam's just the perfect front man, and Noel the perfect songwriter, and you know, it is just great.
I've got a question for you then. Who would be in the band?
Just those two and session musicians.
That
it doesn't really matter, does it? It's sort of proven how the band comes and goes. It's just those two, isn't it? That's the band. It doesn't matter, I don't think. Sorry to, I love all the other guys who have been in the band, you know, but it doesn't matter. They're the main focus of it, aren't they? They're the ones that we all tune in for.
Watching the Nebworth footage and watching the Nebworth film again, the one thing that could never happen again is just seeing an audience that's totally immersed in being there. No one's holding their phones up. No one's texting each other. You know, everyone totally living in the moment. And I just think that time has passed. And I think, you know, to see, you know, Oasis get back together and play Nebworth again and just, you know, 125,000 people holding their phones up would just be slightly depressing, I think.
The one thing I do think, I bumped into a bloke the other day. We had a bit of road rage, and he opened his car window and went, "Tim, I haven't seen you for ages." And he's a record plugger, and he said, "It's exciting." And I went, "Why is that?" And he said they're looking for legacy bands again, and the TikTok thing's got tiring for the record labels. I don't think they're making enough money out of it, and it's all back catalog with the bands like Oasis and Beatles and stuff. So they're looking for some legacy bands. And I was talking to a musician who's a friend of my daughter's the other day, and he's brilliant. But I was going to him, "Mate, get yourself in a band." And he goes, "Oh, bands are so square now." And I went, "The problem with being an individual artist is you're constantly talking about what your problems are." So I have a lot of artists come on Sunday brunch and they're talking about mental health issues and how miserable they are, or if they're in love or whatever. When you put a group of people together in a band, they start talking about issues because you have to spread it out between what the five people think. I mean, obviously there'll be love songs and stuff in it. There always is. But there's also like, "We all hate Boris Johnson" or something, whatever it is. But they're like, "What are we going to be singing about?" And you can see, and I think we're missing that with bands at the moment, because we haven't got anyone singing about the social issues of what's happening. And even like, you know, the Oasis songs maybe weren't super political, but they were singing about being a rock star, living forever, and come and get it. You know, you want it, mad for it. And I think we're missing that, don't you?
No, 100%. I think, you know, going back to the previous generation, you know, what we're talking about earlier is that, you know, the Clash and the Jam. And as a kid or as a teenager, you'd buy the NME religiously, and you'd want to know what Joe Strummer thought about whatever it was, the 3-day week or the miners' strike or whatever it was, you want to know what these guys were thinking. They were your way of understanding, because they had the same, their understanding of a situation explained it to you, and you kind of trusted them. And I think Paul, that was part of the reason for Paul pulling the plug on the Jam, I think, as well, because he didn't really want to be the spokesman for his generation. He felt that was too much of a responsibility. But you kind of look to see what these guys were saying, and there's no one like that now. You know, whatever's going on in the world, even Bono, God bless him, you know, and I'm a fan of his, you know, he's sort of taken a, I think he's been shot down so many times now. People saying, oh, what's he know that anyway? Oh, what's he getting involved for?
Yeah,
that he doesn't. So there isn't a voice anymore, you know, in the same way that you'd had John Lennon or even Paul McCartney, you know, saying, you know, give Ireland back to the Irish or whatever it is, that just doesn't exist anymore. Everyone's kind of got a playbook that they have to follow them. You know, they've all had media training and whatever else. And it just doesn't, with Oasis, if they were a fictional band, someone would probably say, if you were trying to write them as characters, someone would probably say to you, you know what, tone it down a bit. No one's going to believe you.
Simon, listen, I try and keep these an hour, and we've reached the hour, which is brilliant. I got real confidence that there's going to be another band or something movement come along soon. I mean, we've gone too long. Like, even when the dance music happened just before Oasis, the whole rave scene or whatever, that was huge. Something's going to happen. I think it's going to happen very soon. So watch this space. Exciting stuff. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Really enjoyed the chat. Hope I didn't go off on too many tangents.
No, it's absolutely brilliant. I could talk to you all day. Cheers, Simon.
This is Rick Burgess from The Rick Burgess Show. If you're still auto-renewing your car insurance without shopping around, you are probably throwing money away. I'm telling you, go check out Insurify. In about 2 minutes, totally free, you can compare quotes from over 100 companies all in one place. Now, here's what I love. Insurify actually monitors your rates and alerts you when prices drop, so you never miss out on a better deal. Millions of people have used it to stop overpaying, and there's no reason you shouldn't too. Do yourself a favor. See what you could save right now at Insurify.com.